could not bear to stay in my rooms. The thought of remaining indoors with that perfume all around me was repugnant. I slipped on a coat and went out into the late autumn sunshine. I spent the morning in the Botanic Gardens, then had a light lunch in the cafe. The prospect of returning home depressed me. I needed to see someone to talk over what had been happening. Remembering that it was only a short walk from Inverleith to the Dean village where she lived, I found a telephone and rang Harriet. She was at home, and yes, she would like to see me. There was something she wanted me to look at. "Let's go out," she said when I arrived. "I can't stand being cooped up in here all the time." We took our time, walking slowly beneath the Dean Bridge and along the Water of Leith to St. Bernard's Well. "I wanted to show you this," she said. She reached into her coat pocket and drew out a photograph. "This was taken on our wedding day 6 years ago." My eye caught sight of Harriet first, her veil pulled back, her face shining. Beside her stood a thin, bent man, who was, I guessed, her father. But then I looked closer and saw that it was Ian. "I don't understand," I said. "Are you saying Ian was already ill when you married him?" She shook her head. "When that photograph was taken," she said, "Ian looked as healthy as he did when you first met him. I found this after he died, when I was looking through our photograph albums. And not just this. Every photograph I have of him has changed, as though he'd always been just days away from death." I stared down at the photograph, unable to comprehend. "Surely it's not possible," I said. "How possible were any of those things you've just finished telling me about?" We walked on. "I can't do anything now for Ian," I said. "But I have to find a way to put an end to all this for myself. And you. You may be in danger too." "If I were still active in the church," said Harriet, "I'd suggest an exorcism or whatever it is they do in these cases. I prayed for Ian night and day. The whole congregation prayed for him. But it didn't save his life. And what about you? Will it be enough just to stay out of Milne's way?" I shrugged. I had not really thought much further than that. Keeping away from Duncan certainly seemed the essential thing, but perhaps I could do more. "I still have all my books," I said. "The ones I bought and a few Duncan gave me. Maybe I should get rid of them." "Get rid of everything," said Harriet. "Your notes, photographs, anything linked to that business. If you cut yourself off entirely, there'll be no way Milne or anyone else can get through to you." I saw Harriet home, then took a bus back up to Toll Cross. Still new to the area, I stayed on too long, getting off halfway up Brunsfield Place. I decided to walk back through the side streets and alleys that meander through the district. What it was exactly that first drew my eye to the shop in the cul-de-sac, I do not know. I had noticed a pub in the corner and thought I might go in for a drink. But as I turned, my attention was caught by a small leaded window flanking a low door on my left. The sign above was evidently old, covered with the accumulated dust and grime of years. I could make out neither name nor trade. Approaching the window, which was dark and partly covered in cobwebs, I peered in. To my surprise, I could make out behind the dirt-caked glass several piles of old-looking books. In the gloom of the shop beyond, a dim yellow light was burning. It seemed that I had stumbled across a second-hand bookshop, so far off the beaten track that I had never even heard of it before. This surely would be the ideal place to get rid of my occult collection. I tried the handle, and to my surprise it turned and the door opened. The interior was poorly lit, and it took all of half a minute before my eyes adjusted to the gloom. A musty, decaying smell filled the air. A door at the rear of the shop opened, and a stooped figure emerged. I took him to be the proprietor. His white hair hung loosely down to his rounded shoulders, and in his hands he held a black, ivory-handled cane. His eyes were bright blue and disturbingly direct. They seemed almost the eyes of a young man trapped in an old man's body. "Were you after anything in particular?" His voice was soft, melodious and measured, with a faint trace in it of, what, menace? Disdain? "The thing is," I said, "I have quite a few books I no longer have any use for. I wondered if you might be interested in looking at them." He tapped his cane on the floor. His eyes did not leave my face. "What sort of books?" I explained as well as I could, emphasizing my research and playing down my personal interest in the subjects in question. "Well, come again and bring some of them with you," he said noncommittally. "I'm sure we can do a deal. And by all means, have a look round. You may find something of interest." It occurred to me that the place might be worth a glance, and half an hour later my expectations were realized. I found a good copy of Desperate Remedies by Thomas Hardy, a book I knew that Harriet was keen to have. She'd been talking the other day about how difficult it was to get decent 19th-century editions of Hardy's early novels. The old man was sitting in an armchair at the back. I handed the book to him. "I'll wrap it for you. Just give me a moment." He passed through the curtain that screened the back room from the shop proper, taking the book with him. A short time later, he reappeared, holding a well-wrapped parcel in one hand. Smiling, he handed it to me. "This was the book you wanted, wasn't it?" "Of course," I said, taking it from him. "Thank you." And I set off, the parcel under my arm, buttoning my coat against the chill of the coming night. The first thing I did on arriving back in my rooms was to pack all my occult books together and put them in boxes in a cupboard on the landing. There was a sense almost of victory in doing so. I was putting all the evil of the past year behind me. At 7 o'clock, the entry phone buzzed.
"It's the police, sir. Would you mind if we came up?"
There were two of them, a man and a woman, both younger than me, both looking a little embarrassed. The woman cleared her throat.
"We're glad we caught you in, sir. You're not on the phone, so we were asked to call. Glasgow CID need to talk to you."
"What is it about this business of my wife's grave?"
"Yes, sir, it is. They'd like to see you tonight, if possible. Apparently the grave has been opened again, sir. They want you to go over. They have something to show you. If you don't have your own transport, we can take you by car."
We were in Glasgow less than an hour later. My escort waited while I was taken to an interview room. 5 minutes later, Inspector Cameron, whom I had dealt with previously regarding Katrina's grave, came in.
"I'm very sorry about all this, Dr. MacLeod, but they'll have told you what's happened. I just wanted to see if you could shed any light on what we found when we went out there this afternoon."
"What you found?"
"Aye, in the bottom of the grave."
There was a knock, and the door opened. A constable in shirt sleeves came in, carrying a shallow cardboard box. Cameron approached the table, beckoning me to accompany him. He lifted the lid. Inside were half a dozen assorted objects, neatly arranged. I felt my heart shrink as I looked at them. One was an Arabic talisman. Beside it lay a sheet of paper inscribed with a European magic square, the text written in Latin. Next to that was a silver ring, a goat's hoof, a shallow bowl with traces of dried blood along the rim, a nail.
"Why are you showing me these?" I asked.
"They mean nothing to me."
"Are you quite sure, sir?"
"Sure, of course I'm sure. You're not suggesting I had anything to do with this."
He shook his head, standing back against the wall.
"I know no reason to suggest anything of the kind. I was just curious, that's all. You can guess what sort of thing they represent, though, can't you?"
I nodded. I was finding it hard to keep control of my voice.
"And there's something worse than that."
"Worse? I don't understand."
"That wasn't all we found in your wife's grave today."
He put a cigarette between his lips and lit it. Smoke filled the still air between us. There was a child's body, he said. A boy, about a year old. We think he was buried alive. I decided to ring my father in the hope of persuading him to come a day or two earlier than he'd planned. I needed his advice and support in this fresh dilemma. It was my mother who answered. Andrew, thank God you've rung. I wanted to get hold of you, but you aren't on the phone now, and I've no idea how to get in touch. What is it? I asked. Is something wrong? It's your father, she answered. He's been taken ill. Very ill. Though Dr. Boyd cannot say what the matter is. He woke in the middle of the night on Thursday, not long after you spoke to him, with a most dreadful headache. I gave him tablets, but they did no good, no good at all, and by morning he was much worse, doubled up and vomiting. As I listened, I felt my skin grow cold, then hot, as though I had developed a fever. Andrew, can't you come to Stornoway? My mother asked. You're not working now, and you could be a great help to me here. I wanted more than anything to go there in order to be with my father, but as I was about to answer, I realized that travelling to Stornoway was out of the question. If Duncan had brought about my father's illness, just as he had done Ian's, it could only have been for one purpose, to prevent his coming to Edinburgh to see me. My arrival in Stornoway might very well prove my father's death warrant. I'm sorry, I said. There's been more bother here over this business with Katrina's grave. The police are carrying out an investigation. They want me to be available. But give Father my love. Tell him I'm sorry he's not coming. Perhaps you can both come as soon as he's better. He'll need a holiday. Is there no way of getting in touch with you, Andrew? I'm worried. In case anything happens. He'll be fine. You shouldn't worry. Look, I'll ring every night, and I'll look into getting a phone installed. I'll speak to you tomorrow. I walked home, shaken and afraid. Questions buzzed through my brain like flies. How had Milne known that my father planned to visit me? If he had used something belonging to my father in order to set his spell, how had he come by it? And why was he so intent on acting against anyone who threatened in some way to come between him and myself? Back in the flat, one thought in particular would not leave me alone. It returned to me again and again, and in the end I could stand it no longer. I got up and went to the filing cabinet in the corner. A drawer at the bottom contained a large photograph album. I lifted it out and returned to my chair. The album contained my photographs of Katrina. I only looked at one. What I saw was enough. Enough to haunt me for the rest of my life. It was the first photograph of us taken together. My friend Jamie had posed us one summer afternoon outside the Burrell, my arm round Katrina's shoulder. I had expected to see her now in the final stages of her illness, just as Harriet's photograph had shown Ian shortly before his death. But that was not how Katrina looked at all. She was dressed in a long white garment. A hood covered her head and face. And my arm still lay where it had always lain, round her shoulder, pressing her to me.